Hi, I'm Bruce Dickinson, and you are watching and or listening to Life Minute podcast or TV or radio. No, not radio. No, that would be so old school.
Iron Maiden's Bruce Dickinson leads a colorful life. Besides fronting one of the world's most iconic metal bands, he's also a commercial pilot, flying the band to numerous gigs, a competitive fencer, owns a brewing company, has written films and novels, hosted radio shows, and he's been working for years on a solo project that's also a comic book series called The Mandrake Project. We caught up with him recently at Evergreen Studios in LA to hear all about it and more. This is a Life Minute with the legendary Bruce Dickinson.
Yay, amazing. Bruce Dickinson in the house. Amazing to have you here. Thanks
so
much.
I wish this was my house, actually.
Yeah, me too.
I borrowed it for the day, you know, so yeah.
How are you?
Great. Busy in all the best ways.
Sure are.
Yeah.
What are you doing here today?
We are just doing some Atmos mixes. So we've got an album called Skunk Works, and we've remixed it, and the remixes sound great, but now we've remixed it in stereo, we're doing the Atmos bit as well. And then we're going to move on progressively to other ones. So Balls to Picasso is going to get done, the next one. To Picasso, we're trying to kind of almost like reimagine bits of the album. So there's things we can put on it now that didn't go on in the first place. So instead of just getting something that sounds like a little bit different, you get something that's like, oh wow, that's really cool, you know, something that you can really add things, you know, increase the color, you know, make it more vibrant and all that stuff.
Cool. Now tell us about Mandrake Project, of course.
Well, it's an album and it's a comic slash graphic novel. I mean, you know, it's, if you're a kid, it's a comic. If you're a middle class guy, it's a graphic novel, because I'm grown up and I don't read comics, right? Yeah, but it's a 12 episode comic. The two things are related, but not joined at the hip, you know, so they're independent, freestanding things. Yet they do share a common culture at the roots and things like that, but the story of the Mandrake Project, the comic, is not reproduced on the album. It's not a literal reproduction of anything like that. So it's not a concept album or any one of those type things with Vincent Price narrating it halfway through and all that. No, it's not.
Tell us about the album.
The album, for me, sounds surprisingly consistent, as in consistently interesting, which is surprises me even more considering that it took 25 years to put all these things together. And the last track on the album is the oldest track. It's 25 years old. The one before that is like 20 years old. And then the first two were written last year when we finally got back together after 3 years of COVID and then 2 years of Iron Maiden and then 1 year of me being sick with throat cancer. And then the year before that, I came with a bunch of songs and said, maybe we should do another album. That was 2014. And then the next thing, it's now. And it's like, okay, well, where were we? And we just picked up where we left off, wrote two new songs. And this album actually has been finished for a year. So it's been a bit like frustrating. It sounds too negative, but it has been frustrating because, you know, you want it to come out because we've done it. It's great. Wow, listen to this, you know. But the ways of the world means it doesn't quite work like that. You know, you have to set the release date, you have to work back, you've got to do the press. And because we were really keen on doing double vinyl, that has its own time pressures.
Yeah.
Vinyl is a scarce commodity in terms of acquiring it, getting the numbers you need for the pressings and everything. And that's a whole different cycle of things. But the album cover, the single cover, all of that, I wanted to make as like a kind of enigmatic piece of art that people would look at it and handle it and go, what's going on in that picture? And they are pictures, they're not Photoshop. Although we're using all this digital stuff to record things on, it's still a very kind of analog album. And in fact, the stage show, when we take the band out, people say, oh, what's the stage show going to be like? Because obviously Maiden, you know, we have, you know, big scary monsters and big huge things and pyrotechnics and all the rest of it. I said, well, this thing is, it's not back to 1992. It's not back to 1982. It's more like here we are in 1972. What was going on then, you know? But people who've listened to the album, they get that. They go, oh, wow, that's so cool. So you mean it's just music? I mean, yes. It's music and everything else, and we don't have any like weird, funny little monsters, you know. They named a lizard after me the other day.
They did?
Yeah. There's a lizard in I think it's in Peru or South America. They discovered a new lizard and they named it after me.
Oh my goodness.
I have my own lizard, you know. Enoi something Eos Dickinsoni.
Does he make like amazing noises?
It has. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure lizards are very talkative, you know. I mean, but it's a cool looking lizard. It's like a green thing,
bet.
You know. I mean,
it better be.
Lizards are, you know. So yeah.
That's so cool. An Eternity Has Failed. Is that the old one you're talking about?
The last thing that happened after we one finished mixing the album, and two, I got the comic accepted at Z2. The last thing I had to do was come up with a title for the record and the comic. So I wanted it the same title, that both would share the same title. And I didn't have one. I'd done this whole album, I did not have a title. Well, I did, but I couldn't use it anymore. So the title was originally going to be If Eternity Should Fail. Now, because Maiden used that track, always my intention to kind of repossess the track. But because the story had moved on of the comic, I changed some of the words. I changed some of the verse lyric to make it reflect a bit more the story of the comic. And I thought, well, Eternity has failed, which is great. It works with the end of episode one of the comic. But If Eternity Should Fail is kind of out of date now as a title. What the hell am I going to call the record, you know? I mean, If Eternity Should Fail was actually an episode of Doctor Strange. That came from comics in the first place. And back in 2014, I was thinking of doing one comic. But by now, we've got 12 34-page episodes going over the next, basically, 3 years. Mandrake Project as a title came up because I thought, well, what do I want people to have as a reaction? One, if they see that as the title of a comic. And two, if they see something as the title of an album. The one thing I thought about Mandrake Project for the comic is it looks a bit conspiratorial. It does look like some secret government project. What the hell is this? You know, maybe is it like the Majestic 12 or something, you know, and like, you know, Roswell kind of stuff. So I quite liked it for that reason. But then when I put the same thing on the record and allied it with the photographs and the cover art, it looked and felt like to me that it was a kind of a bit of a puzzle. It was a bit of an enigma. It's like, so you pick it up and go, that's really cool, but what is it? There's the perfect way to approach a record. You know, you buy a record, you know exactly what's going to be on it. Why bother? But you buy a record and you open it up and go, oh, what's this all about? What's this? Oh my God, why is he in a graveyard? What's he thinking? And that goes back to when I was a kid and I had, I think everybody did this with it, the very first Black Sabbath album. And there's this amazing photograph that ended up being one of the most enigmatic pictures, I think, in rock and roll history. And people stared at that picture for hours going, what is she doing in there? It's just an infrared picture. And I think the woman who looks mysterious and she's wearing a cowl, I mean, she was like the tea lady or something, you know what I mean? And they just said, go and stand in that field over there. And it all just kind of worked. We had a couple of shots like that we did. And we did one photo session in one day and got so many great photographs. And one of them was in, that's the back cover, is like, oh, that's it. And the centerfold similarly, you know. But I was dead set, no Photoshop on any of those. Because it disturbs the belief. You know it's fake because, you know, that bit's obviously fake. And kids can spot that now because they can do this stuff on their home computers, you know. But if it's a real photograph, it's like, oh, that's cool. They left all that crap in there. Yeah. That's real, you know. I mean, and that's much more intriguing, you know. That's AI, all the AI stuff that comes out now, that like AI generated this, AI generated that. It's, you know, a bit like chain hamburgers. You know, the first bite is great, and then the rest of the burger is like,
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
That's great. I love it. And your solo work, how is that different for you? And, you know, why did you want to do this?
I can travel to all kinds of different musical universes, obviously all basically within the genre of rock music, but that's a pretty broad church. I mean, when I was growing up, it was. Now it's narrowed down. If you go to, you know, radio stations, like satellite radio stations and stuff like that, you sort of like, I see there's 150 stations and they're all playing entirely separate categories of music, you know, which I find just kind of annoying because it's quite frustrating, actually, in that people have been able to identify and, what's the word, segment different chunks of the audience. For me, the music was growing up was completely the opposite, was that there were no boundaries to what you could listen to. So if you wanted to listen to Motorhead 1 minute and ZZ Top the next and Django Reinhardt the next and then Genesis the next and Jethro Tull, what's the problem with that? There is no problem with that, you know. And the culmination of all that ends up basically being the Mandrake Project.
So we know who your inspirations were, so you just dropped them, I think.
I dropped a few of them, but you could chuck in Deep Purple and Arthur Brown and Black Sabbath and Van de Graaff Generator and all these weird ass, but some of the weird ass bands. I mean, I'm a child of the 70s. I was lucky in the back end of the 60s, like Hendrix and all that stuff was very present, you know, at the beginning of the 70s. And then the 70s took it to levels of technical expertise that people in the 60s couldn't really dream about. It was a long period of like great music. I mean, some obviously average music, but it was really exciting to be around. And that kind of dovetailed for me with punk, because I was at university in the East End of London when punk was going on. And funnily enough, we used to stand in the bar and get drunk, and there was the jukebox, and we would argue about what to put on the jukebox next, right? And a proper old jukebox having discs and stuff like that. There were quite a few new wave or punk stuff on there, and there was like old like Purple stuff and things like that. And he's passed away now, bless him, but one of my contemporaries there, he was a geography student, I was a history student, was a guy called Steve Dagger. And Steve Dagger was the manager of Spandau Ballet, or became the manager of Spandau Ballet, and was really involved in the whole like new wave scene and everything. And he would, you know, we'd be getting drunk and he'd go, I'm going off to a secret Pistols gig tonight, you know, and stuff like that. I wasn't implacably opposed to punk, but I saw it as being more of an art school type thing than a musical thing. I get why it's a look, and it's kind of a musical look as well. But beyond that, beyond one album, where does it go? And the answer is it can't go anywhere, because, you know, musicians want to progress with music. Punks were not interested in particularly progressing with music. And then musicians realized that, hey, if, you know, I got to look like a punk in order to go and do this. And then they morphed it and it became new wave and or whatever the hell it was after that, you know, and it got taken over by musos who just dressed as punks, you know. So it didn't take long for the music industry to subvert itself and get back down to it. But I was always like into rock music. And of course, we were roundly dismissed as being like Stone Age creatures or like, you know, stupid people. It was mildly annoying, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, and a lot of bands were thrown on the scrap heap, people kicked out of record labels because of a fashion thing. You know, I guess that's pop music, you know, but rock music has never thought of itself collectively as a group of fans or bands. It's never thought of itself as being pop as in ephemeral pop, as in disposable. It's like we're always looking for eternity, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's funny. Yeah.
Did you always know you wanted to be a musician?
No, I had no idea. I mean, when I was a kid, I dreamed about being an astronaut. I'd have settled for an astronaut, fighter pilot, submarine commander, tank commander, any of those things, you know. And then Didn't get into music really until I was like 13, whatever, when 14. I had a couple of records, but I didn't have, there was no music really in the house. Dad used to play occasionally. I mean, I had some records like Edith Piaf and Frankie Lane.
I like Edith Piaf.
Both, actually now, it takes you years to overcome ignorance and prejudice, you know. And so there I am listening to Edith Piaf going, she's actually really cool, you know. Mm. Funny enough, as is Frankie Lane, you know, because he did some great stuff. I mean, 310 to Yuma is a classic, you know. I mean, the film soundtrack track, but it's the original 310 to Yuma song sung by Frankie Lane, I think. And it's brilliant, you know. And he's kind of a precursor to that whole Johnny Cash thing, which again was something I came to later, realizing, you know, just what a genius he was, which is probably weird for sounds weird for a heavy metal singer to say, but unplug your prejudices and, you know, leave your ego at the door and go, this is great.
When did you realize you had this voice?
When I got fired from being a drummer in my band. I wanted to be a drummer, you know, I mean, because I was one of these kids that was always bouncing off the wall. I mean, these days I would probably, they'd take one look at me and they'd like medicate me at birth, right? But back then people didn't do that shit. You know, there was no like ADHD or ADD or any of these, you know, DDDs. So it was just like, yeah, he likes to bounce around a lot. What should we do with him? And so, I mean, back in the day you'd get sent to sea. So that was it. And back then it was just like, have him climb a tree. You know, oh, he's good at climbing. Oh my God, he's fallen out. He's dead. Oh, he's not very good at climbing trees then, is he? Next, you know, like, so it was this kind of hard knocks, you know. I decided that drums was the way to go because it was a physical instrument. You were banging and clattering and making a lot of noise and stuff like that. But the logistics of carrying a drum kit around, I thought, that's a pain in the ass. So I started out on bongos. I like borrowed a pair of bongos from the school music room, and we had this little kind of band of a couple of guitar players and a bass player and me on the bongos. We were massacring Let It Be by the Beatles on the bongos. And the guy that was the singer, who was the bass player, and he allocated himself the job because he was in the school choir, but he had a bass voice. So it was like, when I find myself in times of trouble, like that was like, you know. And so we got to the chorus and he couldn't do it. It was like, you know, that. And they said, shut up on the bongos. You're giving us a headache. Your hands are starting to bleed. And anyway, so give him a hand with a vocal, you know. I was like, yeah, how's it go? He goes up, let it be, yeah, let it be, yeah. Let it be. I said, should I be writing this down? You know, and he said, yes. And said, and then let me guess, let it be. He said, no, whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And two things happened at that point. I thought, this is like simple shit. I mean, if you can write stuff like this and make millions, why be a drummer? Be a singer, man, you know. So I had a go and boom, they went, oh, you're the singer. And then we went downstairs and we split up, artistic differences, you know. And then I got kicked out of that school and turned up to another school, which was near where I lived. It was a boarding school I got kicked out of.
And how old were you?
I was like 17. I'm 17. And so I'm 17 years old, and I'm at this other school, which is like a regular school. It's just like a regular type high school type school. In my class were these three or four guys at the back. One of them, I went to a school when I was like 8 or 9. With his kid, and he played drums. I knew that. And he's sitting there with them and they're chatting away. And I hear this voice going, we haven't got a singer for the rehearsal tonight. What are we going to do? Because he's quit. Oh my God, no singer. And I went, shall I? And I said, I sing a bit. They went, really? I went, yeah. Well, you're in then. That was it. I mean, it properly was a garage band. They played in their father's garage. Yeah, I just turned up and we had the tape recorder. The microphone, they didn't have a microphone.
Jeez.
So they cut you remember that you used to get like cassette recorders that had a little, a curly lead and a horrible microphone on there. They cut the microphone off that, spliced it onto a guitar cable and plugged it into the guitar amp along with two other guitars. And that was my microphone. And
nobody else can make that work but you.
Well, I'm, yeah. So And on we went, and we did like inevitably Smoke on the Water, and we did an album by a band called Wishbone Ash, amazing album called Argus. And for some reason, they'd learnt almost the whole album. So I learnt the whole album of that, and we did a bit of Thin Lizzy and some other bits and bobs. So we did that. We did two gigs in total in our career. I bought a microphone by this point. You know, I went to a music store and bought a secondhand microphone. It was like huge purchase, you know, like that. Yeah, so we did a couple of shows in pubs, and then I went to university. And then I got a bill from the tax man for the two shows, because we'd changed on with the band's name initially was Paradox. I went, that's a terrible name. They said, why? So it sounds like kind of soap powder. I said, you know, I mean, Paradox. And he's like, what is that? It's like, it's either one thing, neither one thing, nor the other. You know, he said, no, you need something epic, you know, like Greek. I said, what about Styx? They went, Styx. He goes, isn't there another band called Styx? I went, they won't mind. I mean, you know, and so we called ourselves Styx. And I might even have a piece of paper with one of our flyers. And it was all, it looked like one of those things that mass murderers send to the police. There's going to be another murder next week, because it was all cut out with terrible letter set, you know, like glued to a piece of paper, then photocopied. Yeah, so Styx. But what had happened was that the real band, Styx, had come into town and done some shows in the UK, like town halls and things like that. And obviously left, and somebody had gone, there was some money. Where are Styx based? And somebody went, oh, look, here's a band called Styx. They come from Sheffield. And they were paid the princely sum of $2, a hamburger and a pint of Newcastle brown ale for doing a gig in a pub. And my parents got the bill of like about $2,000 for Styx, the big American band. So that they we sorted that out, but it was funny, man. I mean, so yeah. And then, yeah, I was at university and I started a band with some friends, and we did a few more gigs. I was getting quite serious at this point. At one point I was the promoter for the university, like social calendar as well. And we were unusual because we had an enormous stage. We had one of the biggest physical stages in London at the time, because it was the Great Hall of the university, was formerly the People's Palace, and it was like an enormous theatre, so a balcony and everything, and a huge stage. So the BBC used to use it for concerts, so they would bring in bands. So I mean, we had like, you know, band like Supertramp would turn up and do like a 2-hour show with the BBC filming it and everything, and a few other bands, Lone Star. We had Ian Durian, the Blockheads, Dr. Feelgood, and then I promoted Hawkwind. So we had Hawkwind with Stacia and Bob Calvert Hawkwind there, which is amazing. I mean, you know, you're sort of 18-year-old kid, and I'm roadieing for Hawkwind, and you know, putting the Atom Henge together and stuff like that. So we're doing that, and then I moved around and joined another band, and finally got headhunted out of that band into joining a band called Samson, who had an album deal, and I recorded my first album with them. I did two albums with them, and arguably two studio albums that completely with them. And then out of that, I got headhunted into Iron Maiden, you know?
Amazing. What did your parents think of all that?
My dad was a bit weird about music. So, I mean, I think he was odd. He was a bit more, slightly to the right of Genghis Khan politically, I think. You know, I mean, I think he was secretly quite proud of it by the time I got to Maiden. But of course, I never told anybody that I was going to be in a rock and roll band. I just lied. I went, I'm going to go to university in London to go and study history because it might be useful. But I had no intention of doing that, you know. In fact, the college tried to throw me out twice for not doing any work, you know.
So you dropped out?
No, I threatened to sue them and I stayed in.
Oh, wow.
It was just complete. I can't believe I did that. I mean, I don't know how you did. Back in the day, they were so frightened of the student union, and they had lawyers and everything else like that. I had two things against me, two strikes against me. One is that they alleged I'd done no work, which was true. And the other one was that I hadn't paid any rent, which was also true, because I had a grant from the government to go to college, and I'd spent all of the grant buying a PA system for my band. So I just used to hide when the rent man came round. So I owed all this back rent. They said, we're going to throw you out for academic insufficiency and non-payment of rent. So I went, hang on a minute, that's two separate departments there, and you're putting it all in the same letter? Is this a conspiracy? You're conspiring against me. You can't do that. You can't throw somebody out of an academic institution. You can take them to court and say, I want the money, but you can't get thrown out for not paying rent. And you put those two things together, what it looks like is that you're out to get me. So I get the lawyer on, and you don't want that. You don't want all that bad publicity, do you?
Oh my God, and you're so, so smart.
So I had six long essays that I had to do about whatever it was, Spanish Civil War or something, you know. I did them in 2 weeks. So you do normally have a whole term to go and do this shit. I'd done nothing. So I did them in 2 weeks and got great grades for them. And I think the guy that marked them, my tutor, it was like his very left-wing, like Trotskyite kind of guy. And we're politically opposite, but he was a nice guy. Very, very talented academic, Professor Paul Preston. I will never know whether or not he marked up those essays just because he liked having me around to argue with, you know, or not. Oh, but I stayed in.
Amazing.
I stayed in. I was just like, you know, I said, it's at the end of the second year. I'll figure out how to pay the rent. I said, but you can't throw me out for that. And in any case, the guy goes, I think you should take a sabbatical for a year. I went, no, I'm not going to do that. Because if I do that, I'll never come back. I said, so I actually, I'm going to get my degree the same as everybody else because it's all sit down exams at the end. There was like 2 weeks of written sit down exams. So, hey, that's a level playing field. I got the same as everybody else. You know, we had 42 people in the year. Two people got a first class degree. Nobody knew who they were because they were never in the bar. One couple people got 2-1 degrees, you know, because they were actually quite clever. And everybody else got what we used to call a Desmond.
What's a Desmond?
Desmond Tutu. A tutu. Second class honours, second division or whatever it was, you know. And one guy got a third. And nobody knew who he was because I don't think he ever turned up to anything, you know.
Oh my God. I can't believe you remember all this.
Yeah.
And how long after that until you just exploded?
About 2 years.
Oh my God.
So I got out of college. I did my final exam in the morning and then I turned up to rehearse with Samson in the afternoon. And that was it. I was off, you know, if you're going to make all your mistakes in the music industry, just try and do them in a concentrated space of time. And we did. So it was like every mistake you could possibly make in the music industry in like about a year and a half, you know. So we were sued. We fired our management very ineptly and we didn't end up firing them. And then they sued us and none of us had any money. So we ended up losing the case. And it's a long shaggy dog story. It's hilarious, in fact. But we should have been the template for Spinal Tap, way before Spinal Tap was ever thought of, you know. But then out of that, I, you know, had this kind of reputation as a singer. And I knew the guys in Maiden because we had links to each other. So the drummer from Samson, Clive Burr, had left shortly before I joined and joined Iron Maiden. So we were next door to each other in a recording studio, and Maiden were doing Killers and we were doing an album called Shock Tactics, and we would all go and hang out in the studio bar and chat and stuff. Lo and behold, you know, they were having difficulties with their first singer, Baldiano, and I was doing a festival gig at Reading Festival with Samson, and, you know, Steve, the bass player, and Rod, the manager, turned up. There were all these festival rumors, all these rumors flying around. Because at the time, I think Rainbow fired Ronnie James Dio and they were also looking for a replacement. Or maybe that was the year before. That might have been the year before. Yeah, they were also looking for a replacement for Ronnie James Dio. I got a bizarre call. I was in my girlfriend's apartment. The phone rang and it was Richie Blackmore's guitar roadie. And I went, how do you know I was here? He goes, I was a friend of a friend. He said, are you interested in the job? I went, well, yeah, you know, and that was the last I heard of it. That was it, you know, and that didn't hear any more, you know. So I would think, well, that was odd, you know, very strange. So anyway, with Maiden, it was different. I got a kind of a interview with the manager that night after the festival.
The rest is history. Bit of a
grilling, you know. And so, yeah, and I explained that I would love to be in Maiden, but I was not going to be like the previous guy in terms of style or in terms of opinions, as in I had a lot of opinions and you either going to get used to it or you're going to fire me in the first 5 minutes. So tell me now, because I can save you the bother of firing me. Just do it now. Otherwise, I'm going to be a pain in the ass, but for all the right reasons. And kind of, that, there you go, lead singer syndrome, you know.
That's awesome. And the rest is history.
Yeah.
Oh, God, what a story. Creatively, what's the process like for you?
I look for, in everything I do, whether it's writing the comic script or whether it's writing film stuff or writing treatments for videos, I always look for the story. What's the story? Why are we doing this? And I do that with songs as well. People always usually ask the question, you know, so how do you write a song? What comes first? Is it the music or the lyrics? And the truth is, it doesn't matter. Something comes first. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it could be a sound, you know, it could be somebody picks up a guitar and just plays some random bog standard chord that everybody plays on the guitar, but it's just the sound of that particular guitar on that particular day, and you suddenly go ding, and a little phrase or thing will just pop into your head. I can play it again, and you've got the germ of something there. And and writing a song is like a snowball, you know, like in the Looney Tunes cartoons, you know, somebody starts at the top of the hill and they're rolling down and the snowball gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's the songwriting process. But you need to have what I describe as the light bulb moment when it goes on, you go, ka-ding, I know what this is about. And then you can weave a fabric around it. And then you can conceal your story. You can have fun with it then. Because then you say, we don't have to be obvious in telling this story. It can be, people can have to chip away at it and find out what it's like. So I love using allegory if I can. What I aspire to in terms of lyric writing is, yeah, it's got to work as the actual sound of the words that come out of your mouth. You know, that's why they're lyrics. But if you can also tell a story and be poetic as well as lyrical, there you go, that's the holy grail. You don't always get there.
How do you hone your voice?
Oh,
undeniable, oof. Legendary voice of yours.
I wish I could say that there's some magic routine that I do every morning when I get up and, you know, up with a lark, and like, I'm like that, but no, you know, my voice sounds horrible, the same as everybody else's voice sounds horrible first thing in the morning, you know, which is what I say. I've done like, what's the word, clinics, things like that, where people sort of talk about singing. And I say the first thing to realize is that all your voices will sound equally horrible in the morning. It doesn't matter whether you're Pavarotti or whoever you are, you sound terrible in the morning because your voice is physical. You've got to wake up your body, you've got to wake up everything, and it's just like 9 o'clock in the morning. What are you doing to me, you know? And the voice is sensitive. So I did spend a lot of time when I was younger teaching myself things that probably you get taught if you go to a singing teacher. So I just spent a lot of time researching the voice and things, and then I asked a bit of advice from one or two people, and then I just tried to emulate, first of all, other voices. And I figured out what voices I could sound like naturally, which I think is what most people do. When as soon as you start playing any instrument, you imitate people you admire. And if you can imitate somebody you admire and you sound pretty close to them, you think, oh, yes, isn't that great? Actually, it's
in the end,
it's not, because you actually have to find your own identity. That's the bit that can be troublesome. And actually, having a technically good voice is an obstacle to that. because it's easy to sound like quite a few other people. And therefore, it's difficult to find out who you are. If you have a voice that is restricted in some way, either by lack of technique or it's just a weird sounding voice or whatever, you accommodate that within your style immediately. And therefore, you become very characteristic straight off the bat. Ozzy Osbourne, prime example. A totally identifiable voice, right? You know, a Johnny Cash the same, a Leonard Cohen the same. Those voices are so iconic and identifiable because they just have this, they sound different to everybody else's voices. So if you have a voice that can do things, I mean, I know opera singers, they do sound different one from the other, but not that much. So rock music is different in that respect. I had a moment back in Samson, funnily enough, and I was working with a producer called Tony Platt, who'd just come off doing the AC/DC record, Back in Black, with Mutt Lange producing that. And he was like the engineer. But he basically got a whole bunch of vocal technique for recording singers and things from Mutt Lange. Mutt Lange is a brilliant singer. He came to Europe from South Africa with his wife, Stevie Lange, who is also an incredible singer. They're not together now, but the pair of them came along, and he's an amazing singer, and he's got a very high, like Robert Plantey type voice. So whenever you do an album with Mutt Lange, half the time, all the backing vocals is him. So, and you can hear out in Shania Twain or Def Leppard, you think, ah, there he is again, you know, like 100 of him, 100 of him going, like that, you know, yeah. So anyway, so Tony comes along, and we had this material with Samson, and he made me sing what I considered out of my normal range. So, you know, you have your normal range and it goes up, 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 and then it goes into a falsetto. So you'd have Ian Gillan or somebody else like that would do the like type scream, you know. And he said, no, don't do that. Just sing, instead of going into that bit, just push and extend it. So that's what I did. And it was a bit challenging, but everybody who heard that record went, wow, that's great. You sound like you. And I went,
like you.
I hate sounding like me. I don't like, who is that person? They said, that's you. That's your voice. I went, but it doesn't sound like other people. Oh, there you are, I said it.
That's a light bulb.
You know, so that was the first stage. The next one was complete despair because we would go out and do gigs and I would just lose my voice. Like after the first show, like I can't talk for 3 days. What am I doing? Here I am with this voice, done this album, and now I can't do it. And I said, okay, calm down. You went away and you did all this book research about vocal technique and everything else. Da 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 da. That's what it's for. Apply your vocal technique to learning to be yourself. Huh. So I learnt to be myself on the record and turned it back into being myself live.
Right.
And then I joined Iron Maiden. And I joined Iron Maiden and I now had this like palette of voice that I could bring there. And I had all these ideas about what I could do to really, you know, because it's kind of almost like mock operatic type stuff at this point. And I thought that would be super cool to do that amount of aggression with that kind of like big voice. So that's kind of how the concept of me singing with them worked.
And your cancer scare, survivor, that must have been.
That's one of those, really? Okay. And the weird thing was, I mean, I just finished an album with it. Yeah.
And you didn't know?
I kind of did know, but I chose not to know until I finished the record. I was having a little funny little thing. I mean, I wasn't like losing weight or anything else like that, but I just, you know, I was always a tiny little bit sweaty at night. And I had a lump in the side of my neck, like a little one, just like when you get a flu and your gland comes up, you know. It wasn't the flu and it didn't kind of go away. It was this funny smell that was coming out from, and I was like, whoa. what is that? So I Googled it all and got it, got the diagnosis absolutely right. And went, don't be ridiculous, it can't be that. And then, of course, 2 weeks later, I finished the album, go see the doctor, and within a week, I'm in front of the oncologist and says, yep, there you go. He said, so we're going to get rid of it for you with chemo and radiation and sign here. I went, oh, I'll sign up to that. Sounds dramatic. I was stage three. It was very interesting because my oncologist said to me, he said, stage three. He said, that sounds bad. I went, yeah, it sounds bad. The next one up is stage four. And that's, you know, he said, no, it's not. He said, I'd rather have stage three of your cancer than stage one lung cancer.
Right, that's right.
I went, okay, that puts it into perspective. Yeah. I said, but why? Please tell me, why me? Well, you know, here I am all like, you know, Mr. Fit and Healthy and running around and doing this. Why me? Is it because I, you know, is it some karma? Is it because I'm in a bad person? He goes, no. He goes, it's just bad luck. He said, I don't know why. It's just bad luck. You know, I mean, obviously my cancer was related to HPV, as almost all oral cancers are, as 100% of all cervical cancers are as well. So there you go. That's a bug that like 90% of humanity have managed to attract simply by making love to other human beings. Nobody knows they've got it. And you get rid of it. Except some people, for some reason, it persists. And it can sneakily make changes that may turn cancerous. And in my case, it had done. So I had a golf ball in the base of my tongue. I had a 3.5 centimeter tumor living there. And I had a 2.5 centimeter, I had a strawberry growing there. And 33 sessions of radiation and 9 weeks of chemo at the same time. It was almost like an out of the body experience because the level of fatigue at the end of it from the radiation was extraordinary. Like nothing I'd ever felt before. I mean, I've been tired, I've been exhausted, but this idea of fatigue that you know, I'd be coming back with shopping from the supermarket and having to walk like, you know, 300 yards and I'd get 100 yards and I would just, I wanted to lie down on the floor on the sidewalk, you know, it was a real eye opener, you know, it was like, wow, that's another level of I didn't know was in me. That was all good, and everything came back. I had people that used to ask me, "Were you worried that you wouldn't be able to sing again?" And I said, "Well, no, because the first thing was to be alive again, and then the next thing after that is okay, what can I do?" And it's that kind of positive spin on things. I was pretty skinny. I lost about 16 pounds during the treatment. Some people lose a lot more. But on the other hand, I was a little bit fat when I went in. And I was, hey, you know, don't recommend it. There's a weight loss program, but take every advantage. The voice thing was the last thing on my mind because I thought, no, number one is to get better. Number two is find out what you can do. Don't say, I can't do X, Y, and Z anymore, therefore I'm all washed up. No, what can you do? That was my attitude as I was doing in the recovery phase, was don't panic, wait, and just wait. Because at first it sounded like a wounded buffalo. I don't know what a wounded buffalo sounds like, but whatever it sounds like, I sounded like that, you know. It was awful. I mean, and I was just, oh my God, you know. And then after about 10 months, I was just wandering around and I felt pretty good wandering around the kitchen at home and nobody there. And I just thought, let's have a go now. And it was there. I was like, oh my God, it's there. Let's have a go at the top notes of Run to the Hills. Oh my God, they're there. It's all there. You know, in fact, some of it was better than it was before. It was so weird. I was prepared to do whatever I could do with my voice after it. Nobody loses their voice. They might lose the ability to sing in a particular way, but you never lose a voice. As long as you have something to say, you always have a voice.
I love it. The gloom and doom of some of the lyrics.
Oh yeah.
Because you're a big person.
No, the album's dark. I mean, the comic book is darker still.
But you're not like that. So where does it come from?
No, I'm not. It comes from things that have happened to me in my life and things that have happened to other people. It's as simple as that. And nobody wants to hear songs about how happy you are. Who does that? You know what I mean? I'm just like, I don't want to hear songs about how happy somebody is. It's like, so it's drama. It's drama. And drama, it's never good. You know, there's no drama if everything is fine. Everything's wonderful. Where's the drama? A lot of the album is about life and death. And I've had a lot of life and death in my life and potential death and people who have actually died and things. That leaves scars inside, which I don't go around wearing my heart on my sleeve telling people about, because whatever things have hurt me or hurt other people, I own it. I own it. I'm not going to inflict it on other people. It's not their stuff. It's my stuff. Own it. Get on with the future. Don't live in the past. In fact, not even get on with the future. How about getting on for like what's in front of you right now? That's actually quite difficult because we're pulled so many ways, particularly with social media. It's so tempting for people to live in the past, you know? So whether it's politically or socially or wherever, you know, I was always much better in the old days and blah, 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 and everything else like that. You know, respect the old days for what they were, but that's not now, is it? Now is like right now. So that's not going to help you right now. And living in the future isn't going to help you right now. Oh yeah, someday my prince will come. Well, he or she is not here right now. So right now is what's in front of you.
Yeah.
And live for right now. I don't know if there's a God. I don't know. People want to believe in a God. Fantastic. I might have done once. I'm really not too sure about it now. But, you know, I could be open to persuasion if somebody can tell me a reasonable reason why such a thing should exist or provide any evidence. But in the meantime, this life is all you've got. If it's not, it's a bonus. But this life is all you've got, so live it for every day, and life is better than all the other options on the table.
What does music do for people?
It can do all kinds of things. It can piss them off, it can make them angry, it can make them cry. But what it does is it gives them an escape. That's what it does for me. If I listen to a piece of music and I'm absorbed in the music, the world dissolves around you and you're there. The other thing that music does, which is, I think, unique amongst, I get shot down, somebody else say, oh no, this does it or what that does it. But no, I think music uniquely transports you across time. So for example, things I listened to, you know, when I was 13 or 14 years old, if I listen to that track now, I am 13, 14 years old. I can picture the scene where I was when it was happening. Music is the only thing that does that. That doesn't happen with a movie. It doesn't happen with plays. It doesn't happen with books, you know. But music is a direct plug-in to like the brain of the cosmos that has all of that stuff in it. And music can do that.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.